From Vermont Public, this is The Frequency. I'm Anna Van Dyne.
And I'm Abigail Giles. It's Tuesday, April 25th. Here are today's headlines.
Housing advocates are calling on lawmakers to extend an emergency motel housing program that's scheduled to wind down in June. 1,800 Vermont households currently live in government-subsidized motel rooms. But under the budget approved by the Senate Committee on Appropriations last week, more than 90% of those families would lose housing by July 1st. Ann Sawson with the Vermont Affordable Housing Coalition says many will be forced onto the streets, where they will potentially face severe outcomes.
Including increased risk of death. And so we should be concerned that this will result in both immediate and sustained harms to the population.
Advocates are calling on lawmakers to keep the existing motel housing program in place until the state can safely house people elsewhere.
Vermont is trying to get more graduating college students to stay in the state. That's by offering to pay $5,000 of their student loans if graduates agree to work for a Vermont-based company for 2 years. It's a new program funded through a workforce development bill that state lawmakers approved last year. Michelle Carodi with the University of Vermont is helping administer the program. She says about 50 students have applied so far from all over the state.
It's not just Chittenden County, which is really nice, but it's working. People are excited. People are wanting the money, and they're clearly getting jobs here.
Carodi says applications will be accepted through the end of the year. The program has enough money to accept 400 students who graduate this spring with a bachelor's degree.
And now, a remembrance. Peter Miller documented the lives of ordinary Vermonters for decades. His photographs are honest and intimate, black-and-white snapshots of rural Vermont and its people. Hillary Miller is one of his two daughters.
He loved the farmers of Vermont and the people who he considered real Vermonters and kind of lived life on their terms just like he did.
Those who knew Miller say he was bright, articulate, and often frustrated, and at times disgusted, with the way the world was changing. And he was compelled to document what was being lost. Something about the farmers, their barns, the lines of a person's face, or the palm of their hand. Miller, over his more than 60-year career, tried to present people as they are. That's why he photographed in black and white, as he explained in a 2014 interview.
It's abstract. It goes right into them. You don't look at the color, and the color doesn't bounce back at you. You look right into the photograph, you can get a sense of the person.
Miller published several books of images and accrued numerous accolades over his long career, but the most important thing to him was always the work itself, the people, the photographs, and the stories they hold. Miller died last Monday. He was 89 years old.
Coming up, being a person with means in a world of growing inequality. That conversation after this. What class are you? It's a question that our colleague Erica Heilman has been asking people for a series about class and cultural divides that we've got in the show this week. In this installment, Erica speaks with Montpelier attorney Mike D'Onofrio. Here's Erica.
Mike D'Onofrio moved to Vermont with his family when he was 2 years old. He grew up and he left Vermont for college and law school. Then he moved back to Vermont and worked in the attorney general's office. Now he's in private practice in Montpelier, and he plays bass in a few bands. I asked him what class he is, and here is some of what he said.
I grew up comfortably upper middle class. I went through all my schooling without becoming saddled with student debt. You know, I'm white, I'm male. That puts me in a position to have a lot of stuff, you know, happen more easily for me than most. And I know that there are zillions of people out there who are just as worthy of those things and don't have them.
Why does this feel, or does this feel like an admission?
Yeah, I guess it does. I feel like on some level, it's an admission that I'm part of the problem.
And how would you describe the problem?
Things are not very fair. Money, things, opportunity is not very evenly distributed. And I have more than a person's fair share of it, and most people have less. You know, opportunity, power, advantage, wealth, to an unprecedented degree, it's concentrating, you know, more all the time. And the status quo is working to the benefit of a very small few. Now, your next question to me should be, aren't you one of them? And of course, on some level, the answer to that is yes. But I think the common ground is that I don't think things are working. I don't have any faith in the big institutions that I see as kind of shaping society and shaping the conditions that we live in. All of them have as their prime directive to perpetuate themselves, grow themselves in a kind of zero-sum way, so like at the expense of everything else. And I think that's what a lot of my friends who sit in other parts of the political spectrum, other parts of the socioeconomic spectrum, I think that's what they think too. But then all of these ways that were then supposedly divided, class, race, gender, whatever, that's just us spinning our wheels and letting the way things are entrench itself even more to our collective disadvantage.
So if we are being encouraged to sort of scrap among ourselves, what, in your estimation, what are some of the antidotes to that?
You know, the writer Johann Hari said, sobriety is not the opposite of addiction. Connection is the opposite of addiction. I sort of think connection is the answer to everything. You know, by connect, I do not mean Instagram and Facebook. That stuff is addiction and like the opposite of connection. And I actually think Vermont has much, like a much better infrastructure for the sort of connection I'm talking about than most places because, you know, for whatever reason, I still think there's this neighborly spirit that's still here and hasn't been as like crushed as I think it has, you know, on the national level and as it, and it doesn't exist in places like Facebook and, you know, whatever.
The demographics here in Vermont are changing for a variety of reasons. What are the challenges therein, and what do you think we ought to be thinking about?
I guess one possibility is to recognize the things that you have or the things about you that just sort of came to you, not based on anything you did or you know, the fact that your family was here in Vermont for, you know, several generations before you were born is such a thing. Like it's just true, but it's not because you did something to have it be true. And so people who are choosing to be here, as long as they're not total jerks about it when they show up, like the fact that they want to be here to the point where they're, you know, whatever, leaving a job, moving a great distance, like that's pretty cool. And the fact that someone's been here for seven generations is also pretty cool in a different way, because that also shows a commitment to a place. So if you ask someone questions about, you know, their status as a seventh generation Vermonter or their status as a someone who just moved here from somewhere else, asking about it is qualitatively different from judging it, reacting to it, taking a position about it. Those are all closing a door, whereas asking a question is opening a door.
By connection, are you talking about, you know, talking about your greatest, you know, hopes and dreams, or are you talking about cupcakes?
I think I actually do have an example.
Okay, let's hear it.
So we bought a camp in Woodbury a couple of years ago, and one of our neighbors, like right close by, his name's Larry, and he's, I think his family's been in Vermont for a long time, and he can do anything. He's got every piece of gear you would need. He knows how to use it. And I feel like Larry and I kind of sit on opposite sides of the whole, you know, Vermonter flatlander thing we were talking about before. But Larry, in the short time we've been there, has been so unbelievably generous and helpful, you know, in a number of situations that have arisen. I have not done a single useful thing for Larry because I'm not capable of it. Like, there's nothing he needs that he can't do himself. Well, I take that back. I looked at some legal papers for him, and I felt really good that I was able to, like, do something in return. But, you know, the first time we met, I was standing in the driveway and we ended up just like talking for an hour, and you read cues and stuff. Like I could sort of tell like all the differences between us, but you know, at the end of the conversation, I felt like we're neighbors, we're on the way to being friends. And honestly, if Larry goes home and kind of like rolls his eyes about me because I'm just like this doofus from Montpelier, that's honestly, it's fine because he's nothing but kind and generous to me in our interactions. And from my side of the equation, what I can say is I think he and I are a pair of people who all of these forces that we were talking about earlier, like the they, are designed to drive apart. But that's stupid because one, you know, conversation in the driveway proved that there's plenty there between the two of us to be good neighbors and friends and to help each other, because Lord knows if there was anything I could do to help Larry, I would. And he has certainly helped me a number of times.
This is Vermont Public. I'm Erica Heilman.
Thanks for listening to The Frequency today. We had additional reporting from Lexi Krepp and Peter Hirschfeld.
Our executive producer is Kevin Trevelin, and our music is by Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Abigail Giles.
And I'm Anna Van Dyne. Talk to you tomorrow.